Okay, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Solera Report. This is the 2020 annual wrap-up. We start the launch of our 2020 annual wrap-up with its unprecedented, the equity overview, and I'm joined by a wonderful financial professional from Pennsylvania, my old home turf, Timothy Cavan, who is the founder and leader of Copper Beach Advisors in Malvern, Pennsylvania. And Tim, one of the reasons I wanted to join Tim is I keep getting the question, how do we find a financial advisor who understands the real deal? I met you in person several years ago, but I'd seen you on email before then.
Yes.
And in my experience, you are one of those absolutely unique financial professionals who really understands the money world, the financial world. You know, you have all the credentials of the well-credentialed classic in a financial professional, but you really want to know about the real deal.
Yes, and I wish there was such a thing as findthe realdealfinancialadvisor.com, but unfortunately, that doesn't exist. And to me, I think that maybe the suggestion that I would make, certainly, you know, you can look up my website, but if you're not in the area, you want somebody local, try to find somebody that doesn't sell financial products and that acts as a fiduciary.
Right.
And then, you know, hopefully if they're acting as a fiduciary, which means that they act in your interest before their own, that if you come to them and you say, I have these concerns and I have this knowledge about what I think is the real deal and how do we incorporate that, that at least they would be willing to talk about it with you. They may not match your understanding exactly, but I think that might be one way to kind of approach that question.
So another suggestion I would make, and tell me if you agree, is that one of the advantages of doing the kind of work you do, particularly with individuals and families, you start to learn all the different risk issues that really harm a family. And you also get an incredible education on the financial blessings resulting from good habits. And what you'll see is that financial professionals who understand the real deal start to make changes in the lifestyle of their family to protect their family from the risks, particularly the healthcare risks. So I'll tell you where you find them. You go to the Weston Price meetings of the local Weston Price chapter. You find the foodies. You find the farmers markets. But what you'll do is you'll find financial professors who are going to extraordinary lengths to make that their children get proper food and a good education. So you'll find them homeschooling or at the Waldorf school, or, you know, a lot of it comes through the kids and the things they do to protect their kids from the risks. So
I would fit that model because we have five chickens and a coop in our backyard. So I'm a fanatic about food. So absolutely, yes.
Right. Well, you look so healthy.
Yeah. Whenever. Well, thank you.
When I should note that for the last couple of Christmases, not this Christmas, we weren't able to do it. We had a wonderful party in Malvern for the subscribers. And you can always see you shining across the room, you know, sort of super, super healthy. Anyway, so let's dive in because I know we're only going to do an hour because your schedule's very tight.
Yes.
I wanted to just do a quick screen share and show. So for every wrap up, there are four commentaries that we publish on the four sections, the first being the equity overview. Can you see that? So the commentary for this equity overview is on the homepage. And what we have here is I've gone through some of the charts that we use in the web presentation. And then the wrap-up has a web presentation. And at the financial section, let me just quick go there. In the financial section, we have the charts. You'll see a section called Financial Markets. And that shows you an even more extensive review of the charts for the year. So we can see performance in fixed income, commodities, and equities, as well as the Rambus chartology, which is Rambus's sort of technical analysis and review of the charts. So let's just dive in and talk a little bit about performance last year, Tim.
Okay.
Walk us through what happened in the markets. Let's start with fixed income.
Well, I think clearly, as Rambus says, you have a bull market going on in a lot of things. And the fact that fixed income was up significantly. I think I've heard you say it on the call before that you may not have, you wouldn't have predicted that, but so we have, you know, bonds across the spectrum of maturities having positive returns for the year.
Right. And I never expected, because we came into the year, interest rates were so low and the problems with the federal credit were obvious. I never dreamed that bonds would gain as much as they have. But it's interesting now that you've seen, you know, we're looking here at the long treasury up 18% for the year. Who would have bet? This is a real conundrum for investors, because where are they going to get income? I mean, now, you know, it was bad enough at the end of last year. Now it's really mm-hmm. dreadful.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I think you have to look at the reasons to hold different types of assets. So traditionally, I would say you hold fixed income in not a small part to protect against deflation. Right. And deflation is something that was always kind of in the long-term rearview mirror in terms of the Great Depression, but that we've actually experienced this year with the lockdowns and things like that.
Right.
So to keep in mind sometimes the reason why you're holding fixed income, but from a return standpoint, I agree with you, it becomes less and less compelling, even from just a traditional measure in terms of return. But then if you add in the real deal, so to speak, and you start to understand the underlying credit issues and the missing money and things like that, it
right.
becomes even maybe less compelling, especially if you want to not participate in that. And so then the other option is, and everything has risk, then the other option is to go more heavily into equities, but
right.
then you have risks that are associated with that. And how can you balance that for your own situation in a way that makes sense?
Well, it's one of the reasons I keep saying to everybody, anytime you can invest money to permanently lower your expenses, it's a no-brainer, because it's a lot easier to lower expenses than to get income. And it's a whole different way of thinking, but you know, it's I think it's a way of thinking we have to do. Okay, so let's talk about the equity markets. The equity markets was quite a wild ride.
Yes.
Did you have fun in March?
yes. And I think it's great that you offer the Rambus chartology, because uh-huh. it gives people reference points. So even with my own client base, when we were experiencing that huge, just straight line down of the market, I just did some basic, simple charting with line charts to give people reference points. Because when you see that thing going straight down, you say, well,
right.
where does it stop? You don't know
right.
where it's going to stop. And
right.
but the work that Rambus does is really excellent to give you both the short term, but also the longer term, and to be able to tie that all together. And I think what I encourage people to do in terms of what we experienced this year is, when you have more volatility, the amplifications get bigger, the range gets bigger. And so if you can expand your thinking a little bit and not be overwhelmed by the scale of the ups and downs, then you
right.
might be a little bit more able to make decisions in that environment.
Right. So one of the things, when I used to manage money, I came to the conclusion of, it was one of my partners who sort of figured it out and showed it to me, was that the successful long-term strategy was not buy and hold. It was a modified buy and hold, where you stay long as you're in a bull. As soon as it turns to bear, you're out, and you stay in cash until you go back to bull. Now, it sounds simple, Tim, but as you know, it's not, because how do you know when you've turned into a bear as opposed to a major? You know, what's the difference between a major correction and a bear? Now, you know, the magic number was always 35% down, and in March, we hit a magic 35% down, and if you got out, of course, that would have been the worst thing to do. At
yeah.
the bottom of the 35 down, because it turned out to be a major correction, not a conversion to bear.
Mm-hmm. The one thing I would add to the buy and hold, so buy and hold traditionally just implies that you totally take your hands off the wheel and you don't do anything.
Right.
And typically, at least for most of my clients, we have a balance between some mix of stocks and bonds and have a target. And what having a target allows you to do is to rebalance, and that's kind of like an old saw, but it
right.
is a useful way to respond in a measured way to market dislocations.
Right.
And so, for example, when you had that down market, almost all my clients said the world has changed and we can't do this. And I had one very math-oriented client. He said, okay, it's down. We're going to rebalance. And he did that. And then talking to him in August, and he said, I have more money than I've ever had in my life. I'm like, right, because you bought when the market was low. So
right.
There's different ways to approach it, for sure, yes.
So one of the challenges I face is, do you hedge or not? Because there's no doubt we're in a bull, and in a bull, wasting money on hedges is wasting money. You know, if you're just going to go up. At the same time, if you live through the financial crisis, you do not have the capacity to live through a 35% down without having a heart attack.
Yeah.
So I always tell people, look, if you don't want to live through that down, hedge. Mm-hmm. You know, and that way you can stay in, but you don't have the heart attack. Now, for the people who have that long-term Rambus perspective, they don't need that. Mm-hmm. And your strategy is then, you know, they waste less money on the cost of the hedge.
Yeah, and right. To me, it's the old saying, sell down to the sleeping point. And if you can, if having a hedge allows you to sleep at night, it's really about expectations and managing expectations versus
right.
the reality. So to me, it's not one size fits all. And for many people, a hedge could make sense. And for other people, maybe they do something else.
Right. So anyway, there are two interesting things in the equity markets that really stuck out this year. First of all, the IPOs are really up, but we had something called SPACs. And which just, I mean, if there was ever an example of funny money, this is it. This is like the tulip bulb thing.
Yeah. And I looked at that. I started looking at what that was, and it's generally referred to as a blank check IPO.
Right.
And I could not think of anything more inappropriate in terms of a way to evaluate an investment than to do no due diligence at all, to just write a blank check.
Right.
And I really couldn't imagine ever investing my own money or clients' money in that, except if somebody knows the insider who's running the pool of money. And then it's kind of a fait accompli.
So one of the things I believe is that what we saw, I just recorded Money in Markets with John Titus, and he put up a chart that showed the gap between, S&P earnings are going down, but the S&P is going up. And the gap has never been this wide.
Yeah.
Between what earnings will support and where the price is going. And I think one of the things you saw happen with the game between essential and non-essential businesses in COVID-19 was a giant sucking sound of small business revenues and profits into publicly traded stocks, you know, and part of COVID-19 was trying to help that earnings line stay up. And, you know, a lot of earnings got consolidated into the big publicly traded stocks.
Absolutely. Yeah. I don't think you need to be an expert to understand how seemingly disconnected from reality the earnings of the big companies are. And I was interested to see that John Titus video where he explained the mechanism for how the Fed might inject money directly into the stock market using a commercial bank as a middleman. So there's some different things out there that I think that could be all going on at once.
Right. I sent you and we'll have this up on the website, but we did an analysis from the time the Going Direct plan was approved in August 2019 to the end of the year 2020 on winners and losers. And one of the things you see is Asia is clearly a winner.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, and it makes me think, and I don't have the answer to why that is. Maybe you do, but it's certainly asked the question, why is that?
I think growth rates.
Okay.
I think pure growth rates. And I also think right now, if you look at those economies, not to say that they're not dealing with a lot of risk, because there's a very big, you know, the two best performers in Asia were South Korea and Taiwan. Mm-hmm. And I think the U.S. and China is in a trade war. And some of that is U.S. corporate work coming out of China and going to what's called the Quad. Taiwan, South Korea, you know, but China did very well too. And several years ago, we did a wrap-up called The Rise of the Asian Consumer, and I just think it's stronger growth rates, and it's going to continue.
Okay.
So
it's interesting that that would be a real phenomenon that might continue into the future.
Well, what was interesting is at the beginning of last year, I was talking with a variety of different money managers, and everyone was saying, now's the time to go into, you know, non-U.S. The U.S. is long in the tooth. It's time to go long developed markets and emerging markets, basically, you know, heavy Asia. Mm-hmm. And then COVID-19 happened and boom, you know, suddenly the dollar saved, the U.S. stock markets say, you know, it was quite pro-U.S.
Yeah. And there's also, when you do that, there's the real economic component, but there's also the currency component of the returns. And when you have, you know, the dollar gets weaker, the dollar got stronger right during the initial meltdown, right?
But
I think it ended down 6% or something, according to the
the
charts. And so when you're invested in non-dollar markets and
it's
the
strong.
Dollar gets weaker, you have a little bit of extra juice or tailwind on your investment.
Right. And that's clearly part of what happened.
Yeah.
Okay. So let me turn to the, let's just look at commodities. I have been waiting for when commodities turn into an opportunity. And it was very interesting to read Rambus because he's saying commodity bull is starting. What do you think?
That his section on gold was really extensive.
Right.
And I think he mentioned something to the effect that gold is the general. And then as they see the general out there, the soldiers start to follow over time. But even just looking at that long-term chart, I was a currency trader in 2000. At the time, nobody thought gold would go above $300 an ounce.
Wow.
But he really gives you in that chart, I think the thing to understand, and he says it in his memo there, is that the chart is really just a visual depiction of all the emotions of all the market participants.
Right.
And that you really can see patterns emerge over time that are, I don't know, you can't easily change those patterns because it's everybody participating. And when that long-term pattern is showing a positive, portends positive things for the future, that's something to pay attention to.
I'll just take a quick look at Rambus Chartology. I love his charts. And when I say that, and this time he had some very interesting commentary. Let me just scroll down. And again, you can find it right under Financial Markets in the Going Direct website. Mm-hmm. And again, that's the web presentation for the 2020 annual wrap-up. Every wrap-up has a web presentation where we build it during the month as we publish. But let me get down to his commodities. The reason I love his charts is not because I use them to predict where the world is going to go, but because it synthesizes such an enormous amount of data about the patterns to date. And he goes long. He looks way back in history. Mm-hmm. So you can really get that perspective. Yeah, so here's his commodities. And if you look at how much the central bankers are printing, I know they've created a lot of offsetting deflation with the pandemic. Mm-hmm. But if you look at how much they're printing, I just expect inflation. So let's turn to, quickly, let's touch on real estate versus equities. But then I want to get to the material you sent me on, are we keeping up with inflation? Okay. We saw the Gallup poll come out again. They've done it, I think, for 18 years now, showing that investors prefer real estate to equities. And in fact, we've been in two decades now where the concentration of ownership in the United States has gotten in the equity markets has gotten more and more concentrated. Mm-hmm. You know, the US traditionally was something where a broad amount of people in the middle class participated in the equity markets. And as we've institutionalized retirement capital, that's been changing. And the emerging markets have not yet picked up on retail investment in the equity markets. So the question is, going forward, you know, how are investors going to feel about the equity markets? And so Gallup comes out again and says real estate is still more popular. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, I have some clients who are in that boat where they've, before they work with me, historically, they invested in real estate because they understood it.
Right.
And they felt like they could at least understand what was going on. Nothing's without fraud or things or risks, but they just were, it was overwhelming to try to figure out what's going on in the stock market.
Right.
And, you know, even if they maybe didn't do quite as well as they could have if they had their money in the S&P 500, it gets back to the sleep at night point. And if it's a way for them to just, even whether they think that the stock market's corrupt or not, to just not participate in something they don't understand and be able to sleep at night and maybe grow their investments over time, it makes sense to me why people would do that.
Right. And, you know, I found it to be the same with gold. Gold is simple. You can understand it. It's easier to follow. If you're new to gold, at the, you know, the time it takes to learn about gold, it's a lot shorter and a lot more fun. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting to me, because now, you know, I do a screen, and so I spend a fair amount of time looking at companies and stocks. And as I, you know, until this year, I traveled a great deal. As I traveled, everywhere I went, I would underwrite all the stocks in their exchange. So it was interesting. In 2019, I was in Thailand. And so I went through all the companies in the Thai exchange. And I found this company that I loved that makes rubber gloves. I just loved them. So I approved them for the screen, but I made a terrible mistake. I didn't buy them. I should have bought them, because when COVID-19 happened, rubber gloves skyrocketed, and they were one of the big winners for the year, and I completely missed it. It's pretty amazing. Funny. But what's interesting is when I work on this Aleary report, all I do is look at corruption by big companies in the stock market. When I work on the screen, I run around the world and I find all these wonderful companies and all these entrepreneurs that are creating new companies that are wonderful and do really useful things. Mm-hmm. But you don't see them if you're sitting in the United States just looking at the stock market. What you're seeing is just more and more quantitative easing and, you know, all this horrible stuff.
Yeah.
And yet if you go around the world and watch how securitization is allowing entrepreneurs all around the world to participate, you know, in building really useful companies, you see a very different picture.
Yeah, and you have such a unique perspective, given your role, to be able to do that. It reminds me of the old Peter Lynch book from Fidelity, right, when he ran the Magellan Fund. He said, just buy companies, like if you use Colgate toothpaste, buy Colgate toothpaste.
Right.
But you have a broader universe of things to look at.
Well, you know, that's a funny story, because as a young associate at Dillon Reed, I was required to go to the annual meetings for some of the companies.
Okay.
And I went to the annual meeting for Colgate, who was a big client.
Okay.
And the chairman was British at that time, and he stood up. There were no women on the board. And there was this activist in like the fur coat and the sneakers who came waddling down for the annual meeting and said, "Why don't you have women on the board?" You know, very New York. And I had watched a 20-minute video they ran that showed all the products. Mm-hmm. And it was 20 minutes of watching women buy products for their children or for their household. You know, it was
women.
And he stood up and he said, "Well, there are no qualified women." And I thought, what do you mean there's no qualified women? What about Irma Bombeck? You need Irma Bombeck on this board. So I went home and I said, sell Colgate, because it's not, they're not going to.
Well, that's a smart decision.
Actually, that was smart.
It's aligned with your values, right? It's aligned with what you care about.
Now, you know what it is? When I look at the board of a company, the first thing I say is, do they have the networks and intellectual capital to have the best intelligence they need to run their business? So I'm looking at it like an intelligence agency. And what I could tell, that board definitely needed Irma Bombeck's intelligence, you know. Anyway.
Quickly, you've mentioned before on your experience with women and men, right, in your company, and that you think the optimal balance is to have an equal balance,
right,
between women and men.
Right. So I'm a great believer in having a balance of what I call the Myers-Briggs profiles and a balance of generations and sexes, because then you get the best intelligence. So that's a whole nother conversation. I won't stop for that, but because I want to get to, are we keeping up with inflation? you sent a very good package to me on that topic. I think it's an unbelievably important topic. So let's just dive in. Are savers keeping up with inflation?
I think that you can look at it in two ways. And if you look at it in the traditional way, I think what I sent you was, I wanted to just mention something called the 4% rule, because I work in retirement is one of the roles that I serve, and people just don't want their money to run out over the course of their life. And,
right.
There's a popular thing called the 4% rule that's published in things like Money Magazine and things like that. And I think that many people may not understand that that rule was created not just with the return of stocks, but with the level of inflation.
Right.
And so if you said stocks before inflation earned 11% a year annualized and inflation was 4% inflation was something that caused them to be, this after-tax return of stocks is 7%.
Right.
And inflation is 3%, then 7 minus 3, that leaves 4% for you
right.
to be able to withdraw over time. It's more complex than that, but it's just to kind of boil it down. And that's the difference between the return that you get when you see what the S&P 500 returned for the year and the return that you get after you subtract inflation.
Right.
So historically, the level of inflation has been reported as the CPI as a common measure. There's different versions of the CPI. And that, I believe, started to change through the 70s and early 80s when the government started to change the measure, together with the fact things historically, like we went off the gold standard and you had the Volcker Fed, and you had some things going on where the government, I think, it wasn't in the government's interest to keep recognizing the real level of inflation.
Right.
And so they changed some of the statistics. And then, so there's other sources, like you mentioned the Chapwood Index all the time.
Right.
And for example, if you have 4% left over after inflation for yourself, and that's using 3% inflation, if you use the Chapwood Index inflation level of 8 to 11%,
right,
then that will erase the 4%. So it gets back to, and I think that the things like you've said before, which is managing your cost is one way to do it, and just pay attention to costs in your life. But it's also something to be aware of, that you can't just automatically say 4% is the number and not be aware of inflation.
So I'm just going to show you the Chapwood Index for a second. Let me just share the screen. So the guy who put together the Chapwood Index, I think he's a money manager in Chicago. Mm-hmm. His mother got squeezed to death between Social Security and the cost of living. And so he decided to put together an index that showed, it took the top 500 items in a household in mm-hmm. the 50 largest cities and just said, okay, what's the increase in those cost of goods? So it does so these are the first top 10 cities. And generally, it's interesting, San Jose used to be 14 or 15%, it's come down. One of the reasons I chose living in Tennessee after the litigation was, if you look at the Chapwood Index, it's one of the areas with the lowest cost of living increase. Because at that time, if San Jose is 14% and Memphis was 8%, that's a huge difference over 10 years.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I chose a very low cost area because I figured, you know, I had three properties. My combined taxes on those three properties were $500, which is unbelievable. And so even if it tripled,
yeah,
I could handle it.
And I think you've mentioned before, sometimes when people ask you questions about relocating and things, personally, I used to work in New York City with my wife. We lived in Hoboken and we had a high cost of living. So relative, even to move where we live in outside of Philadelphia, it was a lower cost for us.
Right.
Because of that differential. But if you move from Tennessee to Philadelphia, your cost might go up. So you have to look at where you start and where you end up. And does that make sense?
Right. Right. So I'm a great believer in planning using something like the Chapwood Index, because you've got to deal with the real cost of living that you're dealing with. And we've seen extraordinary movement out of the two coasts into the heartland. And I think that's part of the driver.
one thing I think I take away from the Chatwood Index is if you apply the Chatwood Index to the traditional numbers, you realize that there's no investment that can sit, can magically have you keep up with the Chatwood Index. There's no Chatwood investment number. And so what it does is it forces you to look at other aspects of your life to be able right. to manage that, because you can't just buy an investment that's going to keep up with it.
So here's what always struck me when I was doing individual investment advisory, and that was families would spend an inordinate amount of time trying to ensure that their assets were growing, whether they invested in gold or real estate or equities, and then it would all be wiped out by one vaccine injury or one healthcare fraud or one, you know, bizarre litigation out of left wing or government enforcement. In other words, you had these risks that could broadly be defined as coming from corruption that could literally wipe out 20 years of hard work.
Yeah. And trying to at least think about those potential risks is something that can be extraordinarily valuable. Like you say, if you're able to make a simple decision that eliminates or greatly reduces the risk of some litigation or something, you may never even realize the value of that decision because you right. didn't experience the negative effects. But absolutely paying attention to other things, all the other risks that can be greater than just having a 35% decline in the stock market over 3 months or something that we had.
I used to have a partner, Dylan Reed. You would have loved him. He'd say, number one rule of making money, don't lose money.
Absolutely.
Okay, so one of the things I really enjoyed about Rambus, I always enjoy Rambus, and Rambus is always a little bit different every quarter. But this one, I really enjoyed what he had to say about commodities. So before we leave Rambus, I just want to ask you, what do you think? You know, I know commodities is going to drive us crazy in terms of household expenses. Mm-hmm. So I'm confident commodities are going to go up when it comes to paying our oil bill. But what do you think the opportunity is in commodities? Do you think there's an opportunity yet?
I don't know. It's like many of these markets that have gone up in value, and you wonder, like, where am I? Do we have more to go on the upside or not? I think in Rambus, he gives an analysis that gives you kind of a trading range on gold between, I think it's 770. 1775 right. and the 2011 high, and he explains how that works as the bottom barrier and the whatever 2020, it's not 2020, but it's like $2,020 on the high side, right. and that it may end up being a range there that gold goes into as it consolidates. And to me, that makes sense. And then if you're trying to make decisions about when to enter or exit, and you follow that type of approach, it gives you reference points. So right now we're at 1900 or something on gold, which is in the middle of the range.
Right.
And it's hard to say, I either want to buy or sell because it's in the middle of the range. But if it gets closer down to the 1775, you might consider buying.
It's clearly going to be a buy. I think gold's going to have another good year. I do.
Yeah.
I do. Okay. So let me talk about questions, because we've gotten a lot of questions at year end. You know, everybody's doing their planning. Mm-hmm. And one of the questions we get every year, and we've got again, is IRAs and 401ks, can you trust them?
Well, you know, I think that you've seen things like the SECURE Act, which was passed at the end of 2019. And that is like the opening salvo into bringing money out of IRAs, because IRAs, when you put money into them, you don't pay tax, and the government doesn't get their money until the money comes out later.
Right.
And what the SECURE Act did was it got rid of what was called the stretch, which was the ability to stretch out withdrawals over not just your own life, but the life of your children.
Right.
And now you can still do it over your own life, but when it passes to the next generation, they have to take it out in 10 years. And that means bigger amounts coming out that go into a higher tax bracket that end up giving the government more tax money. So to me, that's the more moderate type of thing that, you know, I think sometimes when we say, are these things secure, our mind immediately goes to like the extreme. Would the government confiscate IRAs or 401ks?
So my concern has always been, and they floated this one time a while ago, and then it just got slaughtered, was that IRAs and 401ks would be converted into annuities. And at the end of your life, your children wouldn't inherit it. Mm-hmm. And essentially, by converting into annuity form, you could force investment in the U.S. Treasuries.
Well, it's an interest. I can't say that wouldn't happen. And by the annuity, also, you would make so the Secure Act shortened the time when it comes out. If you do the annuity, it'll even shorten it more, which means
right.
you have $1 million and you have to take it out over the next 10 years. More money is even going to come out to the government. And then if you force them into treasuries, that would be another thing. These things are all possible, I guess. I can't say it's not possible.
So my attitude,
the resistance of people if they did that. I don't know.
I think the resistance would be enormous. What I always said to some people, these are vehicles where you're in business with the government and you want to make sure that you don't have all your assets and things which are necessarily in business with the governments. So there's a balance. I had a very nasty experience during my litigation with the government over my 401k. And so when I settled the litigation, my accountant said, oh, well, we'll just refund, we'll fund up the 401k again. And I said, nope, I'm never doing that again. But I'm different because I want to get on the Salary Report and say whatever I want to say and not feel conflicted. Mm-hmm. And given the politics they played with my 401k, I'm never letting the government into my money in that way again. But that's me, other people.
It doesn't have to be that of an extreme example. I have clients who were executives at a particular company, and they had a view about what was going on at that company. And when they retired, it made more sense for them, given the risks of keeping the money in a pension system versus taking out a lump sum and even not putting it straight into an IRA, which is what people traditionally do, but paying the tax bill on that immediately. And it's a big tax bill, but that's a decision that can make sense for some people depending on their situation.
Right. Right. So one of the things I always say to somebody is if you take advice given generically, but not looking at your own individual unique position, that's bad advice. Because everybody really, that's what I discovered being an investment advisor. Everybody's different. Everybody is really, really different. And your circumstance, your place, your talents, your skills, everybody's different. I did want to point out, I don't know if you saw Skidmore's report on TSP, the government savings plan. He just reported to me not that long ago that there is apparently a significant exit of Treasury employees.
Really?
And he and I are wondering if they read his article and just want to make sure they get their money out of the TSP.
I did read that, and I sent it to some colleagues who are in the fixed income market, and nobody wanted to comment on it. So even in the investment world, sometimes people are just don't want to get involved.
Right.
Dr. Skidmore raises excellent questions that I don't think we have answers to right now.
Well, I'm trying very hard to get him to do online economics education. Because the need for that is extraordinary. And he has such high integrity. And he, at this point, I think he's pretty clear about the real deal.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, do it yourself. As I said before, I'm always encouraging people to disintermediate their balance sheet and invest in things that lower their expenses. Any thoughts or comments on that?
I think if depending on your community, connect with, since I'm such a food person, just connect with things that are in your community and
right.
locally. And it could be food. It could be shared community efforts in different things. I think to look at more of an endogenous view of things within your control is a good way to approach that.
Right. Think resiliency.
Yeah.
ESG, obviously I'm interested in ESG because of the screen we do. And we just, last year we wrote a wrap up on all the abuses in ESG, but I just saw the visual capitalist came out and said, Big trends for 2021. The number one on their list is ESG is coming into its own. And I said, oh no.
Yeah. That really has the potential to be very bad, or I guess if you do it in the right way, which is not easy, it could be very good. But it really, the specifics matter, I think. And it's, I think that to me is something that's very hard to do individually. If you're trying to go out, now you could do it, I guess. It depends who you are and what your background is. But
well, it's funny because I've bumped into more and more people who are beginning to realize, you know, they're so disgusted with what they're watching on the news that they just, I remember is during the big brouhaha over Epstein last year, it came out that one of the top hosts on Disney's news channel had got the story on Epstein and had gotten censored. Mm-hmm. And I know who censored it. It would have been the chairman of Disney, because I used to have an associate who was the Disney chairman's assistant. Mm-hmm. And the news division would send in their headlines for the nightly news, and then he would delete them or change them. You know, it's very controlled. So this person saw Disney in their portfolios, their money manager bought Disney, and they realized, oh God, you know, I hate that guy. You know, I've had enough with seeing it on the nightly news. I don't want to own it. You know, so we're starting to connect the dots, and I think that's good. So,
and one other thing to mention just quickly on that is that sometimes things, an example of things in your control, I can't remember where I saw this study, but I think it was out of Monsanto that they had done an internal study, and it was some low percentage. So it was like if 15% of people converted to organic food, that put their business model at risk.
Right.
And so even making small decisions like that, which we've done in our own family. Now we only buy when we can, we always try to buy organic, and that's another local way to express a view.
Yeah, to me, it makes a huge difference. I think if we can each do, you know, I call it coming clean. If we can each do what we can do, you know, it can make it can be a revolution. I will say this, most of the ESG financial products I look at, to me, are a source of great laughter and amusement.
Yeah.
So who was it? I think it was JP Morgan came out with a new environmental ETF. And sure enough, the top 10 holdings were the same if you just bought a large cap fund.
Yeah. So, and I wonder if now that ESG is going to be aligned with the Green New Deal and say that that's ESG.
Right. So if you get a Democratic Senate and the new Green Deal and you pull in the guns and then you pile on ESG, it's going to be beyond ugly.
Yeah.
Anyway, sometime we should do... We should review the Goldman Sachs. They have one just for America, of companies aligned with American values. And we should do a real deal on that index. It would be fun. Okay, so you own chickens. The UK's health department just started going to private homes and killing and culling chickens.
I saw that. Just locally, I know the people that – now, I believe in the UK, the chickens had to be registered with the government. I know in my own community, I read my own code and realized that the code allowed me to have chickens. So I didn't ask anybody. I just put chickens in my backyard. But that's a kind of, you can do that where I live, and you have to, jurisdiction, like you say, matters. You have to look at the local laws.
Right. Well, I'm very concerned they're trying to control the food supply. And that's why, to me, it's really important when you look at your assets to think about how can I strategically invest in providing my own food supply.
Before COVID, we've had for the last number of years, we have a cow share. We have a quarter cow. We have a half a pig in our freezer. So the one thing to mention though, is that this does not happen all at once.
It takes time. It takes relationships.
Just get started. So even if you're not there right now, just start with one little step. And over time you build on it. You look backwards 5 years from now, you might be surprised how far you've come.
Right. So, Tim, you're looking forward. You have a group of clients. You're unbelievably knowledgeable, not only about the markets, but about the real deal. So you are the real deal financial advisor. looking forward in 2021, tell us what you think is important next year, what we should be looking for, what we should be thinking about. I'm getting a lot of questions. Should I pay off my mortgage? So I'll throw that one out to you too, but tell us what's on your mind for 2021.
Yeah. So I think, there's still risk in the stock market, but I think every indication, even from Rambus, is that the stock market is likely to continue. And before I got on today, last night, I listened to your interview with Eric Best about scenario planning. And one of the things he said was, people might say, this can't go on anymore. It can only go on for so long. And his answer was, yes, it can. It can go on for longer than you think.
Right.
So I think to not have any preconceived notions and try to have a plan that is appropriate for you and your situation that allows you to respond to the different possibilities. So maybe we'll have increased inflation. And one question I have about that is with regard to inflation is, again, with John Titus's explanation about the Fed investing into the stock market, that is it possible for inflation to express itself with a ballooning stock market, but to not leak out, so to speak, into other aspects of the economy? What do you think about that?
So I think it's very possible for the stock market to balloon without the general economy going into high gear. Because I think automation is going to be very deflationary for labor revenues, for incomes. But I do think it's going to seep in absolutely to household expenses. So I think you're going to see deflating incomes, inflating household expenses, and asset bubbles. And the asset bubbles are going to be tricky because they're not going to be across the board. And we have serious vulture capitalism going on and disaster capitalism. So I think this is a time when you want to be doing everything you can to aggressively re-engineer your household expenses down. So one of the things I discovered when I was running Hamilton was the pricing of telecommunications was so dynamic that it paid me to pay someone to just sit there and constantly figure out how to engineer our bill down every month. You know, it was like economic warfare with the telco companies. And if I paid somebody to just play that game, we would make money.
Yeah.
Yeah. So if you look at the amount of time within a given household that you need to spend on managing risk, given what's going on in the broader sort of operation, whether it's COVID-19 or vulture capitalism. So avoiding risk, but also playing this game of deflating expenses. If you know, I used to always get clients to do time budget. You need to budget more time for intelligence and sort of aggressively managing the change.
Yeah. And so the mortgage that you mentioned, like, should you pay off your mortgage is one way to do that. And I think you just have to think about how much are you at war? How much do you want to go to war or be defensive? When interest rates are so low, traditionally what I've always done is have people carry a mortgage, and make the, what's called the carry. Because you make more on your investments that you're paying on the mortgage, especially if you have a tax deduction.
Right. So it's an arbitrage.
It's an arbitrage. Right. And that can go on forever, even through your retirement, as long as the numbers are, make sense.
Right.
But now then when you start overlaying, if you expect, part of my approach is to be able to not have to go into the bunker or into I think you really can't find a place to hide from this. You have to learn to live in the world.
Right.
And so, you know, even just with lower rates, there's certainly an opportunity for people to lower their costs by refinancing and even shorten the term. So, because most people don't have the ability to just pay off a mortgage instantaneously.
Right.
But you might be able to take a 30-year down to a 15-year if you wanted to. And you said, then in that case, you're saying, well, that arbitrage, Tim, that you're talking about isn't as important to me. It's more important for me to lower my costs. And, you know, so it,
right.
It
and I think it very much gets into individual risk issues. So there's some people where I would recommend that they do it and others where I wouldn't.
Yeah.
You know, I hate to say this, you know, back to my game of economic warfare at Solari, I left a mortgage on because I figured if they burn the house down, it's the insurance company's problem and the mortgage company's problem, so they won't do it.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I'm safer with a mortgage.
Yep. You can think of all different things. Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. Well, any other thoughts for the Solari Group? If anybody wants to get a hold of you, your website is?
It's copperbeachadvisors.com. And my name is Tim Caban. And my phone number is 610-647-4014. So you can feel free to call me that at that information. One quick thing I wanted to mention was that I think a lot of times when we're going to hell in a handbasket and things are collapsing, I've always listened to this thing that says, tend your own garden.
Right.
And I particularly have a garden, so there's a direct way for me to do that, but many people can't do that. And so I started to look into really, what does that mean? How could I do that? And I came to understand that cognitive psychologists have identified the way to be, quote, happy. And that doesn't mean running gaily through your backyard and the flowers. It means, I also use the word contentment. But I find it very valuable. So I mentioned these three things. The three keys to happiness, according to cognitive psychologists, are number one is autonomy. And that means different things to different people. Not everybody has 100% autonomy. The second thing is meaningful connectedness with others. Increasingly difficult in lockdown, but I don't consider communicating through a phone to be meaningful connectedness.
Right.
And then the last thing is the development and exercise of competence, which can otherwise be called pride of craft. And you could think of an old craftsman building skills in carpentry over time. And so just look at your own life in those three aspects. And if you can improve even just one of them,
do it.
You may find yourself more content and more mentally resilient to deal with these kinds of issues in the world that we're living in.
Right. I always found that, you know, again, I used to always have I still do. I have a time budget for the next year. Where am I going to invest my time? Mm-hmm. And, you know, so you're planning on investing your time here, and then the world imposes and you can't, you know, you can't do that.
Yeah.
And the first thing I always say is, okay, what's on my list that I can do?
Mm-hmm.
And what's amazing, if I just keep doing what I can do, it's amazing how much you can get done.
Yeah, but you have a list. So when you have the list, you can just look at the next thing on the list. When you don't have the list, then you may lose time, I guess, trying to figure
right.
things out.
Right. Whatever you do, don't use it watching TV.
Yes. Yeah,
okay, well, Tim, it's been great to have you on. We're in cahoots, and I hope you'll keep me posted. You know, if you see important things you think we should be covering on the Solari Report, let me know. We're changing our mission statement, you know, our little vision statement to say, yeah. helping each other live a free and inspired life.
Okay. I love it. I love this intelligence network. I'm happy to be a part of it. And thank you for the opportunity to be on here and talk with you. And I look forward to being in cahoots.
And there's nothing I would love more than to see you at Christmas time next year in Malvern, PA.
Absolutely. If our governor allows it, I will be there.
Have a great day. Bye.
Take care.